All right. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Morello. I'm an architect with Microsoft Services. I've been at Microsoft for about 13 years and looking forward to sharing some of those experiences that we've had over that time working with our customers, particularly as we talk about transitioning to this new mentality of a devices and services world and really all the different choices and new capabilities that that exposes to you as customers to not just build new applications, but really to think about the way that you're even running traditional IT and how do you leverage those capabilities more effectively in your own organizations. So this is a 200-level session in the architect track. So just to set some context here, we're really going to be looking at the kind of the overall problem space. What are some of the tools that are available? What are the design patterns that you would use to be able to solve some of the issues that are out there today? But if you're looking for like an in-depth session on App Fabric or on auto tiering, there's plenty of those sessions that are here this week. That is not what this session is. So I won't be offended if you're looking for something a little more technical, if you'd like to find a different session. But this one is really, again, focused on the patterns and practices that we use in that hybrid world. So the idea is that at the end of the session, you'll have a really good understanding for the different choices that you can make from an architectural standpoint about what is private, what is public, what does that hybrid kind of combination there look like? What are the different kinds of design solutions that I can use to get to that hybrid approach where I'm able to choose the best of what exists in my current data center as well as what exists from public cloud providers, what exists from service providers out there as well. So that's the focus for this session. Just to take a quick look at the overall agenda, we're going to start out by defining what the actual space looks like. In other words, what is private cloud, what is hybrid cloud, what is public cloud? I think a lot of people probably might hear me say that and wonder, well, those seem obvious. I think I already know what that is. A lot of people do, but unfortunately, the term cloud has kind of become almost abused by every company out there, Microsoft included to some degree, in terms of taking a definition and kind of adopting it to make it look like whatever suits your own products and technologies, right? So there's definitely degrees of cloud washing, I think, as Gartner said, that they go on out there. So I want to set the context for what that really is. You know, what is truly a cloud service? What's a cloud operating model? And what are the things that distinguish that from kind of a traditional on-premises model or just something that's using a lot of virtualization? So once we define what that looks like and what a hybrid cloud actually is, the next thing that we'll do is to look at what are the application patterns for that. So this is not really, this is more of an infrastructure, I guess I would say, focus session. We had one just previous to this that Uli did that was really focused more on application patterns, but we're going to look a little bit about the application stack and the options you have there, because increasingly, even if you're an IT pro, somebody that's been more focused on infrastructure, there's increasing, I guess, need for you to at least have an understanding of the application patterns that you're supporting, because the ways that you're thinking about infrastructure now is much more closely wedded to the applications that you're deploying than it may have used to have been. So if you think about years ago, if you were an infrastructure administrator, you wanted to provide somebody essentially with, here's a virtual machine, and you kind of go and build it and deploy it, and you know, you're responsible for it as the application owner to do with it as you need to. If you think about where this new world is taking us, and we'll look at that during the session today, it's really increasingly important for you to really have an understanding for really all the things that the application wants to achieve, because there's different pieces of that infrastructure, different pieces of those cloud providers that you can bring to bear to solve those problems most effectively. So it's not just simply providing somebody a virtual machine or providing them a LUN and letting them go out and do what they need to on it, but really if you understand the application, you're much more capable of really solving that from an infrastructure standpoint in a much more complete way, much more efficiently. So we'll look at those application patterns pretty briefly. And then we'll take a look more in depth at the hybrid infrastructure world, because that's really, when people talk about hybrid cloud, that's usually the kind of mentality that they have is, how do I blend things that are in my own data center with things that are in a public data center, things that might run in AWS or that might run in Windows Azure or might run in Rackspace, and how do I combine those and where does it make sense to do that and what are the advantages and disadvantages of it? And then finally, we're going to take a scenario walkthrough, and without using a specific customer name or reference here, what we're really going to look at is a large, broad media broadcaster that creates a lot of content out there that's syndicated through various cable providers and satellite providers, a lot of stuff that's related to sporting events. And they had for many years operated this this kind of traditional pattern of running an on-premises data center with a whole lot of their application stack running on bare metal and some virtualization over the past few years as well. But they really went through a large refactoring exercise over the past couple of years, driven by some large sporting events that recently occurred, and wanted to figure out how can we really leverage all these capabilities that are delivered through software as a service and Windows Azure with things like Windows Azure Media Services. How can we leverage better the capabilities that are available in our own data center? And so we're going to look at the application that they had, the different tiers that made up their overall video on demand application, and figure out why they made decisions to move some of those things off-site, some of them they kept on-site, what were the decision points they made there, to really try to make it more obvious what those patterns look like when applied in really a real-world sort of fashion. So throughout here, if you guys have any questions or anything that you'd like to discuss in more detail, we have mics throughout the room. Feel free just to go and stand up there, and we can address any questions as they come up throughout the session. So again, we'll start out by defining the space. And you know, as I said earlier, Microsoft is not an innocent player necessarily in this. We have our own marketing department, and sometimes they get a little over anxious about their definitions and how they want to apply things. So what I like to use when I talk to customers about cloud and really what does it mean to really run a cloud environment or to change the way that you operate into a cloud model is to utilize the NIST definition. So for those of you guys that aren't familiar with it, NIST is the National Institutes of Standards and Technology in the United States. They're Department of Commerce. Basically, they're the ones in the United States that are responsible for all the ways of measuring and kind of articulating different definitions, not just in IT, but you know, for everything from defining like electrical standards to the width of railroad tracks and things of that nature. So the NIST definition, by design, is really intended to be very much vendor agnostic and not specific about one person stack or even one kind of delivery model. So NIST defines these five attributes as really requirements of what really makes up a true cloud environment. So you'll notice here that a lot of these things, if you think about your own environments back home, a lot of them you probably already do. You may even do all of them, and you may already operate a true, you know, private cloud or some sort of hybrid cloud in your environment today. But for a lot of customers, they've done some of them, and they've done some of them maybe very deeply, but some of them only superficially or not at all. And what NIST really says is for you to truly have a cloud model, you really have to do all five of these things, and you have to embrace all five of these things pretty significantly. So if we walk through them and we think what this really is and how this is different from kind of a traditional or just a highly virtualized environment, the first one is really around self-service, which is, you know, this doesn't mean that everybody in your environment can suddenly go to a web browser and start spinning up resources in your data center without any kind of controls. This is not like some Wild West thing or what you may see with Azure or AWS where you just get out a credit card and you can buy as much capacity as you needed to. But at the same time, this is also not kind of the traditional IT model where if you want to have a virtual machine or you want to have any sort of resource in the environment, you have to go and, you know, call somebody in the IT department or you have to submit a help desk ticket or something in Remedy or whatever tool you might use. And you wait a while and some human being reviews it and, you know, and then they go out there and manually configure a server, manually provision a LUN. Self-service, the idea here is that you define within whatever the management construct you use, so in Microsoft terminology that would be System Center, you define what the software model looks like and how do you want people to interact with it by setting up a series of quotas and kind of incentivizing them to treat the resources that you have the way that you want them to be treated. So for example, in the self-service model, maybe you say that for a given business unit, the accounting department or the HR department, you only want to provide that group, you know, so much storage or so many VMs of concurrent capacity or so many compute cycles or whatever the measurements may be, you provide those in that self-service framework and then you allow the software model to be implemented by that tool, System Center, to enforce those quotas and to make sure that people are following the right behaviors. But you don't have to have somebody that's actually manually going in there and provisioning a resource when someone requests it. There may be workflows involved, there may be an approval process required, that's still self-service. The key thing is that the user that or the business unit that needs to have the capacity or the capability does not have to wait for a human being to actually go out there and provision or deploy something for them. Again, you define the software model in the system and you allow the system to implement that for you infinite numbers of times. Broad network access is really about saying you can't have a true cloud environment if the only place that you can access that from is your own data center or your own physical network. In other words, if somebody's plugged into your building. there has to be some degree of broader network access to the applications, or to at least a subset of the applications and data that's out there. That does, again, doesn't mean that it's a Wild West and that everybody on the internet can, you know, publicly, you know, can directly access resources in your data center. Doesn't mean that you're using public IP ranges and no firewalls or anything like that. But at the same time, it does mean that you have some capability to access resources and services that are in this cloud environment from whatever device and whatever network location you might be in. So a typical example of that would be obviously publishing in through some sort of browser-based environment, or maybe you have a mobile app or whatever. But you don't have to have somebody that's physically plugged into the wire to use it. They don't have to launch a complex sort of VPN experience. It's a much more seamless and friendly way for people to be able to get access to those resources. Resource pooling is the idea that instead of you managing servers and storage and hardware as kind of discrete individual units, that instead you're managing overall aggregate capacity. And you're not really worried so much where an individual single workload might run, or where a given virtual machine or a given file might be at some point in time. That instead you're worried about the overall health of that entire piece of fabric. So, you know, again, that may sound sort of obvious, and you may be thinking, well, you know, today I don't really, you know, I don't deploy a single server, I just deploy a virtual machine. But the question is, if you're thinking about deploying a virtual machine and you're having to think about what host you're going to place it on, you're still doing some level of sort of discrete resource allocation. And when we talk about resource pooling, what we're saying again is to define that model, in this case inside a virtual machine manager, what all the storage in the environment looks like, what all the compute nodes look like, allow the system to go out there and to manage what the load is and to dynamically reprovision and move around resources in that resource pool, so that when you go and provision a new virtual machine, System Center knows where to place that, or vCenter, or whatever tool you may be using. This is not, again, just a Microsoft thing. So the idea of resource pooling is, instead of you being worried about that single server, that single SAN, or the single LUN, you're managing all that stuff as one big piece of capacity. And you can kind of see how those things build across each other, because for you to have that self-service capability, you really can't deliver self-service to people if you're managing things as discrete units. You have to have that overall pool and deliver out of that pool. The idea of elasticity, again, is probably an idea that you guys have heard a lot, or heard the term used a lot. The idea there is that when you need to have additional resources in the environment, that the environment scales up or scales down dynamically based on whatever that load is currently, or whatever the load is predicted to be. So, you know, a good example of that is kind of that cloud bursting idea, where I've got some application that, you know, I use infrequently, but when that application does need to be used, I can add resources to it dynamically. So kind of the example that you hear a lot about is people that operate maybe a retail storefront around Black Friday, or you know, at Microsoft, we're going into our annual review cycle, and so there's a tool that we use for performance assessments that, you know, 11 months out of the year, nobody really ever looks like, but for that 12th month out of the year when we're doing performance reviews, literally everybody in the company is utilizing it. So you don't want to have those resources sitting there idle, but you also don't want to have a resource constraint where you need it. So elasticity is the idea, again, that you can add that capacity to that resource pool as you need it. And then finally, measured service. The idea there is that you have the ability, even though those resources are being measured and being allocated as an entire pool, measured service means that you can go in and discreetly view and monitor and track usage of resources in that pool based on the user, based on the tenant that they're coming from, the business unit. Basically, how can you get the visibility into that environment that you may be familiar with today if you're using a tool like Amazon Web Services or Windows Azure, or a lot of hosters out there? In other words, can I go back and say that my IT division, you know, ran this cloud for my organization, and that the HR department, you know, utilized X amount of storage and Y amount of compute resources, and it cost us this much money to deliver that, and that if I wanted to, I could have some sort of chargeback or showback capability to the business unit? A lot of people want to get to that point, but frankly, very few organizations that we work with today are really at that level right now. So again, what NIST is saying is that for you to truly operate a cloud, you really have to have all five of these attributes that are there. So if we think about those attributes and you think about a platform that delivers on all five of those, there's different service models that you can deliver in that cloud idea, that cloud concept. One of them, kind of maybe the most foundational one, which is sort of why you see it on the bottom of this hierarchy here, is the idea of infrastructure as a service. This is what you guys are familiar with virtual machines. You've probably been doing for many years already. How do I deliver the ability for somebody to go into a VM, install their software, you know, maybe add memory to it, add storage to it as needed. But really the tenant, the person that's responsible for utilizing that virtual machine, is also responsible for all the management and maintenance of that environment themselves. In other words, the tenant is responsible for going in there and installing an update if they need it, or configuring the application and so forth. You're basically just kind of acting as a more refined hoster. You know, hosting's been around for quite some time, of course, and this is sort of the next evolution of that sort of hosting plus plus, I guess. But you're not actually managing necessarily the application layer on top of it. Platform as a service is also something that we deliver out of Windows Azure. Platform as a service is sort of a, you could almost think of as the future of where infrastructure as a service may be headed, or at least some of it may be headed. The idea with platform as a service is that instead of you managing the servers and then allowing your tenants or your customers to manage the virtual machines that run on top of those servers and that fabric, that you're delivering an even higher level of abstraction within the guest operating system itself. So if you think about Windows Azure, not the infrastructure VMs that are available now, but kind of the initial way that we released Azure, you have the ability to go out there and deploy an application onto Azure without having to worry about updating the host OS, or how do I patch the host OS, or how do I worry about, you know, doing some geo-redundancy and capabilities like that. If I build my application in a specific way and I call a specific set of APIs that Azure is aware of, my application is essentially infinitely scalable. It's geo-aware. It's geo-resilient. So if I lose one data center, it loads able to be picked up somewhere else. And the reason for that is I'm not making dependencies on the way that the virtual machine itself operates. And so that platform as a service, the idea is you give up, if you're the consumer of this, you give up some control of the underlying VM. You know, I don't know or care necessarily what version of Windows Server it's running there, but I know that if I built my application a certain way, I get a whole lot of advantages. It's faster for me to build my app. It's easier for me, my app to scale. It's easier for me to have resiliency and redundancy in my app if I take those trade-offs there. And then software as a service is really more of a finished product that you're purchasing directly from a vendor. So for example, kind of the classic example like that, I guess, would be Office 365, right? If I want to go and I want to provision a mailbox in Office 365, not only do I not see the virtual machine or the underlying fabric that's running there, so I don't see any of that infrastructure as a service piece. I also don't even see a platform as a service, right? I'm not deploying, I'm not managing the Office service, so to speak. I don't really know anything about it other than whether it's up or down based on some status indicators that Microsoft provides. Instead, what I'm actually buying is the actual software as a service. In other words, I get my mailbox, I get my SharePoint site, I get my, you know, my link capabilities, but I don't see anything below that. So if you think about the diagram that you see here and the way that NIST talks about it, you can see these as basically a series of trade-offs that you take. The lower down that you get, the more control you have within the environment, the more things that you as the consumer, the customer of that environment can do. If I'm an IaaS customer, I can go in there and I can install my own custom antivirus software. I can configure my OS to do these different things. I can change the wallpaper or whatever sort of arbitrary things I might want to do within the context of that VM. If I step up above that a layer, it's cheaper for me. I can develop things faster typically. I have greater capabilities that are kind of built in for free to the platform, but I give up some of those capabilities. Again, I don't have control over the way that the OS is configured necessarily. I can't configure and install whatever arbitrary application I might want to, and so forth. And then finally, at the top level, the biggest benefit that I get there is I don't have to worry about any of it. I'm just simply consuming the capability without having to worry about really any of the IT overhead about how it's run and how it's managed. At the same time, though, I'm also giving up all that control, all that capability. Does that mean that there's one right answer in this? Of course not, right? The idea and really what this session is about is to talk about how do I combine those three different sorts of service models and the different capabilities there to solve the problems that I have while still being able to balance all the legacy needs that I have, right? Because if you are a brand new organization, you can see this when you look at the way that a lot of startups behave today. If you're a brand new organization that's just being born into the world and you don't have any sort of, you know, legacy cost and existing applications to maintain and all that stuff, it's kind of clear for a lot of customers that the way to start off is kind of on these top two layers. You know, if you look at the way that a lot of startups and ISVs and just people that are doing any kind of business that has any sort of IT tie-ins, the way that they're doing that right now is if I'm building an app, I'm going to build it as a PaaS app because I don't have any real legacy needs there. I'm willing to give up that control for all the capabilities and the cost advantages of that model. And similarly, if I can procure software, not just my mailbox, but if I can procure my CRM software, and you know, if I can get Yammer and I can get some ERP software, whatever it is, the more that I can buy a software as a service, the easier it is for me to be able to take that capability and use it immediately without any sort of integration work there. But I would wager, not knowing all of you guys, but just you know, kind of a general population of IT pros, most of you have a large population of legacy stuff that you wish you didn't have to deal with, but the unfortunate reality is that you do, right? I mean, everybody here, if I and you don't have to raise your hands in a call of shame, but if I were to ask how many people had NT4, I'd be willing to bet more than one or two people would raise their hands that there's still some NT4 out there. Certainly there's some Windows 2000, and for absolute certainty, there's some Server 2003 or other things that are old that have to be maintained. And similarly, not even on the Windows side, right? Lots of customers have big investments in AS400 and RISC-based Unix and mainframes and so forth. And that doesn't mean that stuff has to go away, nor that it should be, right? The idea is how do we wrap around it and be able to take advantage of some of these capabilities without you forcing you to go out there and purchase everything, deploy everything again, and really have such a disruption into the way that you're running your organization. So if we think about, again, those cloud definitions, and then we just looked at the service models, then there's these four different deployment models that NIST talks about as well. So again, the idea with this is that you can combine those different service models and those capabilities into a set of deployment models that are uniquely suited for your own organization, your own environment. So private cloud is relatively straightforward, I guess, in the sense that private cloud is defined as running all of those capabilities, be them you know, platform as a service or infrastructure as a service primarily, running those within your own physical plant, your own physical data center, right? So you own the hardware typically, you own the physical plant, or maybe you rent the data center space from somebody, but you know, you own it, you run it, you're basically running everything yourself in your own equipment, in your own facility, right? So private cloud is something that is sort of the first step that most customers go to that are you know existing enterprise customers that already have a base of legacy constraints and requirements that are there, simply because private cloud kind of represents the natural evolution of virtualization. I mean, everybody in here has probably been doing virtualization for you know 7, 8, 10 years or so now, right? I mean, really starting in kind of the mid-2000s is when virtualization really started to become a mainstream thing, and you really saw a lot of uptake of it. So there's really a big swell of people saying, okay, we've got all these physical servers, you know, server sprawl was a big buzzword back then. You know, what do we do with all that? Well, we're gonna virtualize all that stuff. And there's really clear ROI, real, you know, kind of easy wins, doing some P2V and so forth. You get a lot of real quick advantages from doing that. You know, and you fast forward a few years into it, then customers kind of hit this wall where they said, okay, we've virtualized everything. We don't have as many physical servers, but now we have an even worse problem of VM sprawl, right? Now we have, you know, all these VMs that we don't even really know what they do, and, you know, we don't know who owns them and where they're at, and because people can spin them up so easily and there's not necessarily a capital cost required to acquire them, there was not the incentives there to sort of control that as there naturally is if you have to get a physical server. So private cloud is really taking those five attributes that we looked at from NIST and applying those within your own data center. So how do you get that resource metering? How do you provide that self-service? How do you provide all those other capabilities like elasticity in the environment that you actually own and manage? So in many cases, that doesn't mean that you have to discard and replace your existing hardware or even your existing software. I mean, the core part of the kind of the Microsoft story and for others as well is reuse a lot of what you've already got. You know, add this management layer to it, add that software model that we define within System Center, but you're able to leverage that inside of your own environment. But private cloud also has, I guess you could say, one primary disadvantage at least, which is the fact that because you're running it in your own data center, you really don't take advantage of the economies of scale that you would get if you had a larger set of people sharing the cost of that physical plant, right? If you think about even the very largest enterprise organizations out there in the world, very few of them have a data center footprint and the economies of scale, both from just an operational standpoint, but also from a procurement standpoint, that somebody like Microsoft or that Amazon or Facebook or someone like that would, right? So if you think about, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but you know, I've heard various stats internally that you know Microsoft buys you know 5% or 8% or whatever, some sort of insanely large number of the total amount of servers manufactured in a given year. Right, and presumably it's similar sorts of numbers for Amazon and for Facebook and Google. But you know, if you look at sort of the major cloud providers out there, the way that we build and operate capacity is at such an order of magnitude different than what most organizations can do. It's almost impossible for you to compete on a kind of a per compute cycle basis from a cost perspective, right? You can't buy the equipment as cheaply as we can because we're placing server orders in the tens of thousands annually, right? Or the hundreds of thousands or whatever it may be. Far larger than, you know, than almost any other organization, you know, you would ever encounter. So, you know, the idea with private cloud was, you know, how can we do that in our own boundaries? Well, you saw kind of at first in the public sector space, but sort of increasingly now in some other sectors as well, organizations that had a lot of common interest say, well, you know, if we're able to pool our resources, we're able to pool our capacity, we have similar sorts of needs and constraints that that we'd like to satisfy, couldn't we be able to operate these capabilities more cheaply? And that's sort of this idea of community cloud. So NIST being a governmental organization, they have a lot of focus on servicing kind of their customer base as, you know, federal organizations as well. This idea of a community cloud, which is basically saying if I have a set of organizations that have similar sorts of needs and requirements, for example, in the federal space, you may have to have FISMA accreditation or FedRAMP certification. You may have to only be allowing cleared resources or U.S. citizens to be administrators of the system, whatever it may be. If you have that common set of interests and you know what that is, it may be cheaper for you to pool all of your organizations and the other organizations together and say, let's all rent this one facility or let's all buy this one data center facility. We're all going to jointly purchase off of a standard set of SKUs. We're going to have a joint pool of operators that manage our services and almost operate a sort of a mini public cloud, if you will, but something that's specifically focused on the needs of our community. And really the reason for that is it provides a balance between that private model, which again is higher cost, you know, greater control but higher cost, and this public cloud model, which for some customers is not always appropriate or not always even possible, depending on the kinds of data they have, the kinds of constraints they have, and just the sort of operational requirements that they want to have. So if you think about like a large federal agency that's out there that may have lots of data that may be classified information, you're not going to put that in AWS, you're not going to put that into Windows Azure. Not necessarily because those data centers aren't secure, because there's, you know, you feel that it's at some specific risk, but simply because from a regulatory standpoint you're not allowed to. And I think that those regulations are inevitably going to evolve. You've already seen a lot of that in the federal space with, you know, increasing interest in partnering with cloud providers to get these accreditations for the data centers. But there's probably always going to be some gaps there. There's going to be some things that you want to be able to achieve or that you're required to do from, you know, because of HIPAA or PCI or whatever the requirements may be that are relevant to your industry, for which Amazon or Azure or Google or whomever it is may not be appropriate. So again, the idea with community cloud is to kind of have a bridge between there where you get some of the advantages of scale because you're pooling resources, but without all the commonalities, maybe all the risk that you would have or the problems you would have running it in a fully public model. So public cloud here is obviously referring to the kind of the large scale internet providers, again, your Microsoft and Amazon and I guess Google to some extent and even Rackspace and other sort of tier one hosters that are out there. So those are kind of the three, I want to say traditional models, but the three primary models, I guess, that you would think of that don't involve combining those patterns together. But what we're really talking about today and what, you know, what you'll see through the rest of the session is how do we talk about combining these deployment models into something that is more of a hybrid cloud. And so when you think about hybrid cloud, don't think about hybrid cloud as exclusively being, I want to, you know, connect my existing data center to AWS, or I want to connect my existing data center to Azure, or both of them at the same time, for that matter. But how do I take those different IaaS patterns, and how do I also combine the different application patterns that are there, and figure out what are the right places where I can most effectively optimize this given set of needs, or this given application I have, by maybe having some stuff delivered as software as a service from a public cloud provider, other things that are delivered as a private cloud infrastructure as a service, and still other things that may be, you know, public platform as a service being delivered through a private cloud that's run on your behalf by a hosting provider. The big thing to take away from the deployment models is there's so much, variation and so many sorts of shades of gray with this that it's really difficult to pin down any one specific solution as fitting solely into one of those boxes, right? Even if you think about sort of the classic Microsoft case of what constitutes a Microsoft private cloud from a product standpoint, if you think about Hyper-V and System Center, right, that's kind of our core building blocks for private cloud, Windows Server, Hyper-V, System Center. Well, if you have those same components running in some third-party data center, let's say you have that running in Rackspace, is that suddenly a public cloud? Well, what if it's on a network that's solely isolated to your access? And what if it's, you know, specifically staff that you've authorized are the only ones administering it? Again, there's a lot of shades of gray there in terms of what is truly public and what is private. And that's why I think the term hybrid and kind of the way that we're going to use it, not talking about a specific thing where, you know, it's somebody's asset in somebody else's data center or, you know, real specific rules about the physical location of anything, but really how do we combine all these different capabilities into a way that really makes the most sense for your specific needs? Again, balancing the cost efficiencies and other advantages of these models with the legacy needs and other regulatory requirements that you already have. So if you think about what are those challenges, why, you know, why do you even care about this? Things are working well. Why are you putting something else on my plate, or you know, what's important to us? These are really the kind of the five ways that we at Microsoft see the dynamics of the market really shifting and really what's driving customers to have a need to sort of reevaluate the way that they're delivering IT. So, you know, obviously everybody's always under pressure to save costs and so forth. That's, you know, I don't think that's anything new. Even back to, you know, 10 years ago when we launched Server 2003, I think our tagline was doing more with less, right? How do we operate more efficiently? That really hasn't changed. It probably never will. But I think one of the things that you know, IT organizations have traditionally maybe not have looked at as importantly, but are becoming more of a focus area is that idea of reduced time to solution. And what they're really referring to there is if you're an IT organization today, if you operate traditional IT and some Fortune 500 organization or government organization, whatever it is, in the past, you've always kind of been a sole source provider, right? You know, if somebody wanted a file server 10 years ago, they had to talk to you to get that file server, right? There was no real practical way for them to go get a file server or print server from somebody else out there. Today, it's a much different world, right? It's very practical and very possible, and in fact, happening very frequently, in fact, that if I'm the marketing department and I want to run a new campaign around Black Friday, and I think those IT guys are too slow to act, I'm just going to go directly to Amazon or directly to Azure, pull out my credit card, buy the capacity I need, and create this, you know, what's kind of referred to these days as shadow IT, right? I don't know how many of you guys have encountered that in your organizations, but frankly, it's something we start seeing a lot more of. And, you know, you see the kind of the argument from the standpoint of the business unit saying, we can't wait, we, you know, we're trying to get these things done, but, you know, IT says it's going to take us 6 months or 6 weeks even, or whatever it is, to deploy this application to the server. We've got to do what we have to, and so we're going to sidestep that process if we have to. And, you know, while you can kind of understand their perspective, that also leads to a lot of really negative sorts of risks and possibilities, right? One example I have from that was I was meeting with a retailer last year right after Black Friday times, right after they had a really kind of their busiest time of year, biggest push of their year. And this retailer is a very large retailer. You know, they have a big online presence, but also a big brick and mortar presence. And they had recently discovered that prior to their Black Friday sales, that their marketing department had done exactly what I had described there. You know, they said, it takes these guys in IT too long. We want to put up these big websites and have this big promo about all these real, you know, real kind of interesting, exciting, low price sales that we're going to do on that Friday after Thanksgiving. Well, where did the advertising department go and put that data? Well, they put it on Amazon Web Services, which I'm not at all implying that Amazon was harvesting their data or stealing or anything like that. But, you know, suddenly they're in a standpoint where when their senior management found out about this, they're saying, wait, you guys are putting very confidential, very secretive sort of product promotional information on the website that's maintained by one of our chief competitors, right? That doesn't really make a lot of sense. And had the IT department been involved with it at the beginning, they probably would have said, hey, you know, there's all these security and risk and other concerns that are involved. But they didn't have the opportunity to say that. And they weren't even like said, hey, you guys need to involve IT earlier. IT was kind of looked at as the organization that sort of dropped the ball and wasn't following up because it wasn't looked at as a failure of the marketing department. It was looked at a failure as IT is why couldn't you satisfy their needs faster? In other words, why couldn't you reduce the time to their solution? So again, it's not all about just lowering costs and some of these really sort of geeky things of, you know, elasticity and so forth like that. It's really about how do you help solve problems to make your customer base, your internal customer base, happier. Because ultimately, again, you're no longer a sole source provider. You are competing now against Microsoft, against Rackspace, against Amazon, and increasingly against a whole series of ISVs and startups, some of whom are yet to even be born out there, right? If you want to go out and provision and get almost any kind of electronic service now, chances are there's somebody out there somewhere on the internet that'll be able to provide that in a software as a service model with nothing more than a credit card, right? If I want to suddenly start doing CRM or if I want to have some project management software, if I want to do payroll, that already exists. So again, if you're not able to deliver that solution in a way that's quicker, better, easier, where your internal organization feel like you're the best business partner for them to work with, it becomes increasingly difficult for you to have an influence on that, and you sort of end up being pushed into this box where now you're just the legacy provider, you're just running kind of the old stuff, not the interesting stuff, and so where does the budget act, and where does everything kind of negative happen? It's definitely going to be in the places where people think it's the most commoditized, the lowest value, the most sort of dull things, and that's probably not where you want to be, right? So given all that, let's now look and say more specifically, what really is hybrid cloud? We've kind of danced around the subject a little bit. Let's look at it in a little bit more detail. So again, remember we're using the term hybrid as not so much a catch-all, but really as a definition to say it's a combination of those different patterns of deployment and service model, but that all maintain those NIST attributes that we defined initially. So when we talk about hybrid, it could be on-prem, it could be off-prem, it could be community, it could be hoster services, whatever, but they all share those five common attributes that we defined at the very beginning. So if you look at the NIST definition, and you think now about like, well, what does that mean in terms of applications? Gartner had a quote, I think last year, they said that by 2020, they're thinking that roughly 80% of applications are going to be in some kind of cloud, you know, be that a private cloud, be that a hybrid cloud, or some combination thereof, that roughly 80% of applications will be, and that the remainder that are not are typically going to be the oldest, the most archaic, the most sort of difficult to change, the most inflexible sorts of things that are out there. Again, not the kind of place that you probably want to be focused on in your own IT careers personally. But if you look at this slide on, or the diagram on the left, I think does a really good analysis to kind of show that, you know, just generally where does Gartner think that this evolution takes place? So if you look at the bottom axis here is time, and going up here on the side is how much of this is really being delivered as some sort of hosting provider or some sort of cloud model. Traditional IT is not going to go away. It's not like suddenly you're going to turn off your data center 10 years from now and never have to worry about running a physical server, configuring a router, or something like that. But at the same time, the proportion of the total IT expenditure that you have, the proportion of the total amount of work that you deliver, the value, I guess, that you deliver to the organization, less and less of it over time ends up being delivered through traditional IT. More and more of it ends up becoming delivered from a public cloud. And you can certainly argue about this like any other analyst organization. They have their own data and their own biases and perspectives and so forth. So I'm not saying this is necessarily exactly the future blueprint, but I do think that the overall sentiment that there is, you know, some transitional period where there's a large slice of private cloud, but, you know, ultimately the place that you get to is that most stuff is delivered through some sort of public model, some sort of at least hybrid model there, is pretty valid. I think it's hard to sit here and say 10 years from now, if we're at TechEd 2013, that we're going to be talking a whole lot about stuff that runs in your own data center and how to automate and manage things that are only in your own facility, right? Even today, if you go to other sessions, if you walk around the show floor, I'd be willing to bet that the great majority of people that you talk to are going to be using hybrid much more so than they talk about things that are in on-premises or private. You know, it's really all about stitching that stuff together. So again, if you fast forward that idea out 10 years, you can really see that transition from IT as being a service provider to really that idea of being something of a smaller service provider, but much more of a broker, understanding all the different services that are out there, all the different delivery models for them, and how do you bring them together and make them available for your business units to consume in a way that respects those regulatory requirements, but also that allows them to take advantage of all those capabilities that are out there. So the real idea with this is that as time goes on, more and more stuff is delivered from public services. It's never again going to go away. There's going to be some on-premises, some local set of IT capability. Some of that may be, you know, existing today, and some of it may actually even be newly added. But that proportion shrinks over time. And the way that shrinkage happens is what you see here on the right. And that's basically saying, you know, of the existing set of applications, you know, if we look at the 100%, basically all the applications today, what happens to everything that you're doing right now? And what that's really talking about is there's this gray segment down here that's saying a lot of that stuff, you know, the darker gray here, gets migrated to some sort of infrastructure as a service solution. Again, that could be something that runs in AWS, could be running something that runs in Azure, could be something that runs in their own data center. More likely, it's a combination of all of those things. The blue part is stuff that's migrated with, or replaced rather, with some sort of cloud-based solution. So what they're really referring to here is some sort of combination of PaaS or SaaS, but basically, how do I refactor my existing application so that, again, I don't have to care about the virtual machine that it runs in or the server that it runs on? Instead, I'm worrying about the application, how to scale out the app, how to manage the app, rather than the underlying infrastructure that happens to support it. But if you look here, all the net new growth, and you can probably think about your own organizations and see at least the beginnings of this trends internally, that what they're really seeing is that almost all the new growth that occurs here is net new stuff that is cloud from the start. In other words, the days of you procuring a new server so that you could deploy a new, you know, mailbox environment or a new SQL server or whatever it is, the days of you going out and physically procuring hardware where you needed to do something are probably at an end if they haven't already ended for you as an organization, right? A lot of people have kind of moved on from that and bought more pool capacity as it is. But what Gartner's really saying here is that if you look out, again, 10-year time horizon, that really all the new investment is going to be running on some kind of cloud platform, be it public, be it private, more likely some combination thereof. Hybrid, in other words, is the future for us, and it's not just a transitional state, but really is the perpetual state for all of our careers, right? If you're working in this business 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, chances are you're going to be working in some sort of hybrid environment. Some stuff is going to be in somebody else's data center. You'll have some stuff on premise. It's going to be a combination of how do you mix those things together that's going to define how successful you are as an IT organization. And the skills and the ability to do that in a way that's thoughtful are going to determine how successful you are as an individual, how marketable you are, and how translatable your skills are to different industries. So let's look a little bit at some of the patterns that are out there. So what I want to walk through now is when we work with customers through a variety of different industries, all kinds of different organizations all around the world, what are we really seeing out there as kind of the general patterns that are driving customers to these hybrid models, and what do they look like, and sort of what are the pros and cons of them? So the team that I run does hybrid cloud, mostly infrastructure as a service is you know, honestly what our real focus is, but how do we do that? And we do that today for customers all across the Americas, both commercial and public sector. So I feel like we've got a really good idea of kind of what the general market looks like in the Americas, at least. And so one of the things that drives these hybrid evolutions is this idea of deployment flexibility. Again, how do I increase my speed to market, reduce the time to solution, as we saw in a previous slide there? And there's really kind of two pattern types that we often see customers use there. One of them is basically saying we're going to deploy first on private and then move the workload to public. And the other one is for the opposite of that. We're going to deploy first on public and then move it to a private environment. So what are those scenarios and why would you want to do it? Well, one of the examples that you see there, the first one, which is deploying first on private and then moving to public, is a really common model if you're a developer and you want to say, I want to have an easy way for me to prototype an application, build that out, but then not have to so much worry about running it myself later. But at the same time, maybe I've already got a sunk cost for a dev and test lab in place. I've already got all my tooling built around that. I don't want to have all that stuff running in Azure. I don't want to migrate that right now. But I do want to have all the capabilities of running that application someplace else, like in Azure or AWS or wherever it may be. But when you make that choice to deploy or develop first in private and then move it to public, the choice that you end up making there is one that basically is saying that, you know, I'm going to be taking a set of dependencies on the tooling and the frameworks and so forth that has a commonality between what I can run in my own environment and what I can deploy into an Amazon or somewhere else. So if you think about what we talked about earlier with the difference between infrastructure as a service and platform as a service, while we as Microsoft want to get to that really true commonality of API where you can build that application one time, run it in your own environment or run it in Azure and really not have to change the app at all, the reality is you're not at that point yet, right? There's some advantages and there's some differences that you can have deploying or building for one environment as opposed to the other. So if you're going to want to have that ability to deploy first in one environment and then move it to another environment, you're basically making the implicit choice to say we are building an application that at least for right now is only going to be able to be deployed as an IaaS sort of deployment model. In other words, if I were to deploy an application first on Azure and I'm building it as a PaaS application, I'm taking a bunch of dependencies in the way the Azure framework works, then I'm not going to be able to simply take that and then run that in my on-premises data center, at least not today. Like I said, clearly that's where we want to go as a company, and there's a lot of things that we're doing to get there. But right now in 2013, you can't say that you could build an application in Azure and then instantly take it and copy it basically into your on-premises data center and have it run without modification. So So if you think about that deployment flexibility model, what you're really saying here is that if I want to have a single workload or a set of workloads and be able to move them from one environment, be it private or public, to the other and not have to change the application, I'm basically making a choice that that particular workload pattern is going to be an IaaS workload pattern for right now. Right? Does that make sense to everybody? The next one, and one we see increasingly more of, is this idea of composite apps. Composite apps are not saying that we want to have necessarily the ability to move a workload that's been deployed from one sort of model to another, but instead to say that we know that our perpetual state is going to be one in which there's going to be some pieces of the application that run in one environment and other pieces that run in another environment. And a really common one, a common pattern that we see a lot of, is customers that say, I've got this kind of standard multi-tiered application. I've got a data tier, an app tier, and some presentation tier there. I've got a bunch of dependencies on the way that my data tier works, right? Maybe I've got feeds that come in from a mainframe or from a Unix box or whatever, and you know, I've got this huge data warehouse, and I've got it really tuned, and it works the way that I want to, and you know, by the way, I'm also kind of afraid to put this sensitive data in somebody else's environment. But at the same time, it's really, really painful for me to have to deal with running all these web servers that front end that and worrying about, you know, doing load balancing. And, you know, like, I hate the fact that I'm trying to basically be Akamai, and, you know, it's not something I'm very good at, and it's constantly causing me outages. So one scenario that we see a lot of is, well, how can I kind of take, again, the best of both worlds there and say, when I want to run that data, that core data set in-house, I can still front end my access to that data warehouse by putting the web tier, or maybe even the web and the application tier, into something like Windows Azure, right? Because now I can put that web tier in Azure, and I can build that as a PaaS application. I can have that infinite scalability. I can have that resiliency in the case of losing a data center. Plus, now I can take advantage of some really cool stuff that Azure does, like content distribution, geo-awareness, and site locality, and so forth. And I kind of get that for free, almost, just by building my application there. So suddenly, I don't have to worry about if somebody coming from the Philippines is accessing my site, or are they going to my data center in Asia, or are they going to a data center in the U.S. that takes a long time to get there. I just know that I've built my application correctly, and Azure is smart enough to know how to do that for me. And similarly, if I certainly have a huge burst in demand, well, now I can just go out there and spin up additional nodes, or even better, I can have Azure do that on my behalf based on the current state of the application demand that it's seeing at a given point in time. Recently, in Microsoft Services, we've actually built a framework for this idea of cloud bursting, which is kind of a similar idea, except cloud bursting is saying, I've got this environment that's running today, maybe in my on-premises world. I've got, you know, my web tier, my data tier, and so forth, all running in my own data center. But now I want to say that when I reach certain thresholds, or when I trigger an event proactively, that Azure is going to go out there and start spinning up web servers that are also going to be added to that sort of that global pool of access tier. So what we've done and what the IP kit that we built enables us to go in there and to say with System Center and Orchestrator specifically and Operations Manager, we can monitor the state of your application today and say, you know, you're running at this threshold, right? You're running at, let's say, 75% capacity. And we've defined in that software model a rule that says when Operations Manager sees that you hit 79% capacity, that we want to build in enough buffer, so we're going to start spinning up a new nodes in Azure. What happens is, Operations Manager sees that you hit 79% capacity, triggers an event within Orchestrator. Orchestrator goes out through the integration pack and talks to Azure and says, go and create me 3 new VMs based on this template that you've already got, creates those VMs, creates the load balancing definitions, and adds them to the pool. So again, without me having to go out there and manually configure anything, I define that software model one time. Now, whenever the application changes dynamically, the software is able to take advantage of all the configuration that we put into it and take care of that problem for me. So I don't get a call late at night saying, hey, I need to go in and add new web servers because suddenly my application is running slowly. System Center already knows what my application is doing. It knows what the load set looks like, and it's already configured and deployed those resources for me in Windows Azure. And that's an example of that composite application where, again, it's not about all private or all public. It's about using the right resources at the right time. So resiliency is a kind of another example that you could almost say the example that I gave you was an example of resiliency because it definitely had a impact on availability and performance. But resiliency is also something that we see increasingly used in the context of disaster recovery and backup. So you guys have probably seen a lot of material out there today on what we have with Store Simple and some of the work that we've other providers have done to back in storage to Azure. So one of the great things that Azure, and AWS for that matter as well, but one of the great things that Azure provides is the capability to have really, really cheap storage that's not in your data center. So if you think about the way that you've traditionally done backup in DR, traditionally, one of the most difficult and error-prone steps in that was, how do I get that data out of my own data center and into somebody else's, right? You know, everybody saw all the tragedy that's happened in Oklahoma recently, and you know, being here in New Orleans and me living here in Louisiana, I can certainly attest to the natural disasters and the problems that causes. So a backup that's only in one location is really not a very useful backup in a lot of situations. But keeping that backup up to date, you know, you could go out there and get your Iron Mountain or somebody, and they could, you know, take tapes and ship them around and, you know, physically storing things. That's really difficult and really expensive. So if you look at the model that cloud integrated storage delivers and what Store Simple does is, it basically does a really smart way of providing auto tiering locally, back-ended by that elastic, essentially infinite pool of storage that Azure gives you. So when you're running your Store Simple appliance or maybe some other device that's in your on-premises environment, and it's running there and you're accessing data on it, in the back end, it's able to take all those cold blocks that aren't being used very often and store them in Azure. And conversely, things that we have like in Windows Server 2012 R2 with the integrated backup capability, we can now not only back up your stuff locally to a tape drive or to local disk, but to say we're also going to store a copy of that stuff in Windows Azure. So suddenly you no longer have to worry about what happens if my data center is lost, what happens if I have a huge disaster that impacts everything. All that data is now protected for me in some other location. But beyond that, there's also the capabilities now of not just using it as a place for essentially cold DR data, but actually how can I extend my data center into Azure and allow me to run some set of my kind of critical services in that environment so that I always have a warm spare, if you will. So, you know, we already have the capability to extend your network with virtual network. You can run a domain controller there. You can run whatever sorts of other infrastructure as a service, VMs, that you may need to, so that you've always got that off-site capability, but it's always connected to your local network, and you have a commonality of management tool sets across both environments. So we talked a little bit about the dev flexibility, about being able to deploy or be able to build in one environment and deploy in the other. So we're not going to get into that too much more, but dev test in general is probably one of the most common scenarios that we see for hybrid applications. So when you start thinking in your own, you know, go back to your own environments later this week, or if you haven't already done so, if you think about the kind of the lowest hanging fruit, if you will, the typically the easiest things to start thinking about from a cloud perspective, you know, where can you get those initial wins? Where can you really prove out concepts? Dev test environments are really great locations for that, because it's typically places that people really rely on a lot. I mean, for your devs and testers, that is their production, well, not production environment, but that is their day-to-day mission critical environment, I guess. If it's not up, they don't do any work. But at the same time, it's also a place where there's a whole lot of churn, right? They're always creating new images, tearing things down. It's a really great location where if you can offload a lot of that work to Azure or to someplace else and still have that integrated with the rest of your systems on site, you can really start taking advantage of a lot of those efficiencies of scale, but to do so in a way that's less risky than running kind of a mission-critical application, so to speak. So what do we see in Microsoft Services? Again, you know, like I said, the team I run, we work on projects all over the Americas and with lots of customers and lots of industries. What are we really seeing today in sort of like cloud enablement applications? Really, a lot of what we're looking at is generally like application modernization stuff. That's a big part of the business that's out there, a big part of what we see our customers looking to do. And you know, we say web apps here, but what we're really talking about is applications that have some sort of web services based here. This doesn't mean that, you know, it's all browser based, you know, HTML stuff necessarily, but really applications that have a web service enablement. How do we take those and, again, take a composite approach to that? Where can we really leverage Azure and other cloud providers to do that much cheaper and much more efficiently than we've been able to do on premises? You also see that the SharePoint implementation is a big part of it as well. SharePoint is a, you know, a place where a lot of customers see a lot of value of running that in Azure. It's kind of by default. It's something that's, you know, you want to have broadly accessible. It's a web-based approach. So having that in Azure not only gives them the capability to run that maybe more cheaply than they would otherwise, but it also gives them a lot of deployment flexibility, because the really nice thing with running SharePoint or any other application is you can scale it up and deploy it from a template-based approach. So when you want to deploy a new part of a tier in your SharePoint form, you want to add capacity there, no one has to manually go and configure what that looks like. You have your gold image, so to speak, in your template library in Azure. You can deploy one of those, or you can deploy 1,000 of those, and you can tear them down and recreate them as needed. So again, that capability to do that very dynamically within Azure really gives you a lot of new flexibility that you necessarily haven't had before. Even if you had a very virtualized sort of private cloud model, you might not have had the physical hardware to do that as quickly as what you can do in Azure, which is, again, essentially infinite to you. So if you guys haven't already seen this slide plenty of times already today, you'll probably see it throughout the week. But the Microsoft Hybrid Cloud Platform is basically the Holy Trinity, I guess, if you will, Windows Server, Windows Azure, and System Center. So Azure provides, obviously, the public cloud side of it, Windows Server providing the private cloud, or at least the components that can be used in a private cloud or a host or cloud. And then System Center is really that common point of management. I mean, System Center is where you have that one tool set where you define, again, the software model, a common set of portal, a common set of operating reporting tools and management monitoring tools that allow us to span both environments. So you don't have to have one tool for managing what's in your current, what's in your on-premises data center, and a different set of tools for what runs in Azure or elsewhere. You have that one tool set, that one software model, and you allow it to span across environments. So that's not just Azure and Windows Server. That could also be Azure and your on-premise environment plus host or cloud that somebody else provides. Plus, maybe you probably saw recently we released a management pack for Amazon Web Services. So the idea is to really consolidate all that logic and all that capability, that entire model, to be completely contained within System Center, so that you don't have to go out there and do repetitive tasks more than once. So again, some example apps that we've looked at. I mentioned a few minutes ago that dev test was a big scenario, so you can see a few of those here. Some of the other ones, DR we've also talked about, the cloud bursting stuff. These are all examples, though, of real customers. I'm not utilizing names, of course, but real customers and locations around the world here that are doing real hybrid cloud scenarios. So, probably the most interesting one, like I was talking about earlier, is that idea of burst to cloud, simply because I think that provides a really great combination of taking advantage of what you've got today, but also really leveraging some of the cost effectiveness and just the general, I guess, elasticity, you could say, of the public cloud. But really, the main message that I wanted to convey with this slide is this is not like a conceptual thing that wouldn't it be cool if we could do this. This isn't a science project that you have to go and spend a bunch of time writing code for, figuring out how to do. This is a very real capability today. There's many, many customers out there that are using these capabilities. This is increasingly where we see pretty much all the business that we do shifting to. I mean, everything that we're doing has some sort of cloud component to it these days, somehow knitting together things that you've already got with things that we deliver or some service provider delivers. So when you think about this, this is not, again, something where you have to go and figure all this stuff out for yourself. A lot of this is already available today, based in what's in the product or what's available in various like tools like TechNet and other locations. And what's not there is increasingly being filled in through Microsoft or through our partners and ISVs that you see out there. But the core message is all this stuff we're talking about with hybrid is really something that you not only can but probably should be using today. It's not a capability that is 2 years off or that we think is going to be coming at some point down the line. Those days are past. I mean, this is real. It's happening. People are using it. And in fact, if you think about it from a really broad perspective, this is something that, again, your competitors are using, not just from a corporate level standpoint that if you're working at Coke that Pepsi is using or vice versa, but from a very specific standpoint for you as an individual, your competitors as an IT pro being all those other organizations that are out there that are delivering services, trying to kind of compete for that share of the IT spend with you within your own organization, they're definitely leveraging these capabilities, these economies of scale. So again, if you want your skills to evolve, if you want your relevancy and so forth to evolve in the market, you've got to take advantage of these capabilities yourself and really build that into your portfolio of skills that you can deliver to your own organizations. So look a little bit, I'm not going to get too much into the app patterns. We're running a little shorter on time than I would like. But basically, again, this is a very common slide that you'll see throughout the week here. The idea here is that if you think about on the left-hand side, the private cloud stack, and again, this could be either running in your own data center or in a host or provider data center, This private cloud stack here and what you see in the public cloud have a set of layers. And those layers have a set of commonalities that you see here in the middle that are shared across both Windows Server and Azure. And the idea being increasingly that what we want to do at Microsoft is to give you a very common set of experiences and APIs, even if the underlying core technologies may be different. You know, the way that we do storage, for example, is very different on Azure than, you know, what you would see in Windows Server. But if we can have a common API standpoint and a common way to manage that and a common tool set for reporting on it, it really doesn't necessarily matter what the underlying bits and bytes are that deliver that to you. And so really this slide is about saying, you know, if you can adopt and you can kind of standardize around the sets of technologies that you see here in the middle as the way to deliver and to solve the problems at each one of these layers, then you know that you have the flexibility now to evolve and to be able to really easily take advantage in the future of things that are maybe more on the public side, or, you know, in the future if you wanted to go more private for some reason, you could do that because, again, you have that commonality of capabilities there. So when you think about the way that Microsoft is going from an evolutionary standpoint with our products, it's really about enabling you as a customer to have a common set of experiences and a common way of managing both in your on-premises environment and what exists in Azure. You know, ideally, I think if you were to articulate where we'd love to be in 10 years, like what an idyllic sort of vision would be, it would be that you really don't necessarily know or even really care so much about where the application is running, right? You kind of make a choice if I want to deploy this application, and based on whatever controls and stuff you put in place, it just sort of goes someplace. And that someplace that it goes is based on the rule set logic that you define in System Center. And System Center is able to route you to the appropriate place based on what you've told it, you know, what sort of requirements you have from a data locality standpoint and so forth. You can do a lot of that stuff today, but it's not the end-to-end completeness that we'd like to have. Again, that scenario that we talked about earlier where if you built an application leveraging Azure APIs, it would be great if you could take that same application without modifying it and run it exactly the same way in your own data center. There's some gaps to that story today, but that direction, that commonality of experience is really a core part of what we're trying to do at Microsoft. I mean, if you think about it just from a kind of a self-serving perspective, that ability to deliver a end-to-end hybrid experience is probably our greatest competitive differentiator, right? If you think about where Microsoft sits in the market and thus where we're more likely to invest, where we're really going to focus our resources, it's in exploiting those competitive advantages that we have. And really, our competitors, we have great, very strong competitors in both the private cloud space, the public cloud space. Very few, and I would argue really no one, has that commonality of experience across both. So that commonality of experience and that ability for you to have a single tool and a single set of frameworks and experiences, that's really what we think is core to what we're trying to do. So we've talked through some of the application patterns there. What are some of the constraints and problems and challenges that you encounter with that? We're not going to obviously be able to solve all these problems, but just, you know, to kind of seed the ideas and the questions for you to ask as you go through and, you know, maybe evaluate applications, or you hear needs from your business units about how do I solve this problem with the cloud. Here's some of the core list, I guess, of questions or topic areas that I like to think about with that. You know, obviously one of those is about deployment. You know, how do I actually get my code running wherever it is I want it to be? You know, it may be as simple as taking that code and sort of doing a forklift approach, if you will, and say, we're going to run it in a virtual machine. It's in Azure. That's all fair and good. But again, you don't take advantage of the platform capabilities. So thinking about how do you refactor, whether you refactor is a big part of that discussion. To me, the biggest thing, though, really is the second bullet here, which is really around identity authentication. If you think about the way that organizations have traditionally managed identity, Active Directory has done a really good job of providing single sign-on and, you know, a lot of other core sort of identity and roaming capabilities within an organization. And it did that really well using the tools available at the time. You know, if you think about when Windows 2000 came out, it really was transformative in terms of the capabilities that it provided, and we've continued to build upon that over time. But it also was sort of built for and has a lot of dependencies, at least, you know, sort of traditional Active Directory has a lot of dependencies on Kerberos and RPC and, you know, all these kind of ugly, nasty things that don't really work so well over the internet anymore. And so one of the things that we're really making a lot of investment in is how do we take Active Directory and not force you to throw away what you've already got, but how do you iterate on top of that and extend that into ways that make more sense in these cloud environments where, again, you've got that broad network access that NIST defines, you've got a lot of commonality of network resources that are there. You have people accessing it from many different devices, lots of which won't even run Windows or be joined to a domain at all. And so we saw sort of that first wave of that investment with Active Directory Federation services, and that's still a core part of it. And now what we're doing as well around Azure Active Directory to allow you to really take all those identities that you have and really build them into your applications in a much more intelligent way than you could if you had to leverage them all through kind of a core old school AD with domain controllers and so forth. Again, it doesn't mean that the way that you've done AD is going away. It doesn't mean that you're going to be shutting down your domain controllers next year or even 10 years from now. But it does mean that the approach that you take to solving those problems is going to be different, and you have to think about all the different tools that are available out there today rather than just always kind of gravitating back towards what you've already got. So we'll take a quick look at some of the hybrid infrastructure patterns here. We've talked a little bit about these already, but again, the main thing to take away from this slide is the idea that you're increasingly trading off kind of levels of control for potentially greater levels of cost savings. So on one of the slides we looked at previously, we talked about, you know, as you go up that stack from IaaS to PaaS to software as a service, you're giving up less control, but you're getting a more of a finished product with less stuff to manage. On this slide, and kind of the way to think about these deployment models between traditional kind of a non-virtualized bare metal approach to public cloud running on off-premises, you're trading off this being the most customizable, where you can do pretty much whatever you want, you can configure it however way you want to this public cloud where it's much less customizable, but it's also much lower cost. And again, if you think back to the slide that we saw earlier from Gartner, it's not a choice of this goes completely away and everything is 100% this, right? It's always going to be some continuum, right? Some dial that you and your own organization are going to turn one way or the other, right? Some organizations may have more stuff that ends up being private cloud than public cloud because either that's just their preference or that's the regulatory environment they work in or what have you. But the key thing, again, is that you have the choice to really combine these in a way that makes most sense to you. And System Center is really the tool that we use to do that. So if you think about kind of the System Center management model here, we're not going to go through this slide. This is kind of a slide that I can spend an entire meeting with a customer talking about. We'll go through it in detail. If you think about kind of the two constituencies that are involved in kind of management of the cloud OS, management of these cloud patterns, it's really your customers, your business units, your application owners, the people that service the infrastructure or use the infrastructure that you run, and then you yourself or your organization that's running that infrastructure. How do you provide that unified capability where you don't care where the infrastructure actually is, but to have that commonality of experience that we talked about? So self-service, again, getting back to the NIST model, is a core part of that. You don't want people to have to go in there and figure out or talk to somebody to figure out where do I deploy this application or how do I do it. You know, obviously, they'll consult with you and get guidance and so forth, but that needs to be as self-service a capability as possible for them to provision those resources in the environment. And you do that by, again, defining the service model within System Center. System Center provides the delivery and automation capabilities for that. And that across both Microsoft's data center and Azure, it's across what's delivered through service providers like a Rackspace or a Savvis, as well as what's delivered on-premise in your own data center. And that you as the IT administrator, again, you've got that common experience and that common set of tools in System Center so that you can manage out across both Azure and your on-premises environment. You don't have to pull up one, you know, web-based console to monitor your servers and your resources running in Azure and a different tool set to monitor what's running in your on-premises environment, maybe a third tool set to monitor what's running within the virtual machines. You've got, again, a consolidated experience for monitoring, for provisioning, for operating, and System Center is really the place where you do all of that work. So if you think about what a common IaaS pattern looks like, if you think about hybrid IaaS today, kind of what a lot of people think of as just quote-unquote hybrid cloud, this is kind of the archetype definition, I guess, of saying, I've got my existing HQ organization here, I've got my SQL servers and IIS servers and so forth, and then I've got some set of resources that I run up here in Azure. And I connect those resources together utilizing the VPN capability, the virtual network capability that we release as part of the spring release here for Azure. And so what it looks like for me as an IT administrator is I have different, you know, subnets, different pools of capacity, different resources running in Azure and running in my on-premises environment. But again, I manage all that stuff through a common set of System Center tool set that runs over here. So me as an IT pro, I definitely can see what's running where, and I can move resources back and forth as needed. But for me as an application owner, the left-hand side of that previous slide, I really don't know or necessarily care where that VM or where that application that I'm accessing, where it actually exists, right? And because you can even bring your own IP space, your own DNS servers, all that good stuff into Azure, it's almost, I don't say impossible to tell, but for somebody that's not really an IT specialist, it's very difficult for you to figure out whether or not when I talk to server1.contoso.com, whether server 1 is in my on-premises data center or whether it's running in Azure. Because server 1 resolves to that same RFC 1918 address that it always has. If I move server 1 from here to there, I don't really see any difference. As an end user, I still access it the same way. It still is just as responsive. It still behaves the same way. If it freaks out and breaks, I still get the same application alert that shows up in MOM. Or, excuse me, SCOM, sorry, name myself. It's really the idea here is that you can move resources around and do so in a way that's very, very invisible, if you will, to your end users and to even you as an IT pro. Again, commonality of that tool set with System Center, that common experience is a really key part of being able to effectively build these hybrid cloud scenarios. So this slide is really just highlighting the fact that, again, the usage models that you see today are not going to be the usage models you see in the future. I kind of disagree with the way that this curve is drawn. I'd probably draw more of it here on the public side than as much on the private side. But the key idea with this is that Microsoft is there throughout the entire journey. And one real quick example of that is what you guys have probably already seen with App Controller. So App Controller is kind of part of our self-service story. It's a way for people to be able to create and provision and manage virtual machines, but specifically virtual machines that are both in an on-premises environment and running within Windows Azure. So I simply, as an end user, I just go to this single portal, I go to this single tool, and I can now provision and manage and monitor resources that are running both in an on-premises data center, some other data center that's running around the world, or a data center that's running in Microsoft's facility in Windows Azure. So the experience that I get is really aligned with a lot of the attributes we've talked about so far that Niske told us. You know, I sign in as my own user. It's a self-service experience, and I get the sort of roles and access that I require. All that stuff is metered. It's all monitored, so I can report back on resource usage by an individual, by a group, by a business unit, whatever it may be. I have the ability now to self-service virtual machines across different clouds. I can provision them. I can do that from a common library, both in Azure and what's available in my on-premises environment. The private cloud view is kind of what you see here, where I'll define what these clouds are within Virtual Machine Manager. Those are bubbled up through App Controller. Now I can see that private cloud capability that's deployed in Data Center 1 and Data Center 2 and wherever all these locations might be in my own on-premises network. But at the same time, I can also manage that stuff in Windows Azure. And so again, this one little snip, this one little shot of what you see within App Controller really kind of brings together a lot of those concepts that we've been talking about already. The resource metering, the self-service capability, the ability to manage across different cloud environments. It's really exposed through this one screenshot, so it's a good way to kind of bring all that idea together. So finally, just a quick little walkthrough here. Again, that scenario that I mentioned with an organization that does a lot of video on demand and other broadcasting. It's not about the power of, tyranny of choice, if you will. The power of and, I think, is a phrase that Scott Guthrie used when they launched the spring release of Azure. But again, it's about being able to combine these different capabilities into one set of services to your end users in a way that they don't have to worry about where things actually exist. So in this case, we had, again, a media organization. They do a lot of live broadcasting, particularly of sporting events, specifically of sporting events that happen periodically at a global scale. They do a lot of distribution, not just to cable and satellite providers, but increasingly now to mobile applications. And so they had this kind of framework where they wanted to not only just continue to deliver these capabilities out of maybe their own data center, but also to have increasing levels of insight into that. So this icon here is really talking about how they could use Dynamics and other tools out there to really take a much closer look into the way the application behaved, not from an application monitoring standpoint, but from a usage standpoint. In other words, if somebody really likes watching boxing, what are the sort of advertisements that we should show to them when they're watching a basketball game instead or something like that, right? How do we really track not just the way that people are accessing the content, but what are they doing with it? What are they using it for? And again, the idea of IT being more than just a delivery provider, but really how do you use IT to increase the profitability of your business overall? So their model was built up, or their application stack is kind of built up with this. This is where they started with, where they had a media library that existed in SharePoint, video on demand services, et cetera, et cetera. And they said, well, how can we refactor all this so that we can have not only those cloud-based advantages of lower cost, but in their case, they were really mostly concerned with how do we deliver this global sporting event? How do we deliver this in a way that's a much higher quality user experience, where you have much stickier eyeballs to it, where people are watching it more, and thus we can sell more ads. And so they looked at each individual component there. You know, they looked at their SharePoint media library and said, this is really too costly for me to run in my own data center, but I've made a lot of customizations to it, and I can't easily put it in a SaaS model or a PaaS model. Perfect place for IaaS, right, like we talked about earlier. You have all the control, but maybe a little bit higher cost than the other two. For video on demand, there's already a software as a service solution for that, Windows Azure Media Services. Let's just use that instead of building our own thing. Similarly, for live streaming, there's already that capability there. Why should I go and build out all that capacity in my own data center and worry about all that from a routing and access standpoint locally when I can leverage Azure CDN to do that for me? For media archiving, you know, I've got all this huge amount of data that I want to keep and make available to people, but, man, I really don't want to be buying petabytes of storage, whereas Microsoft routinely buys petabytes of storage and delivers them very cheaply to customers through Windows Azure. So that's a great place where I can leverage that platform as a service capability to have a very small front end to access this enormous library of sports footage throughout the years. DRM content, how do I kind of protect my core assets and make sure that they're being not, you know, used or put on a BitTorrent site or whatever? Well, I've already got a solution for that. I really like the way that works. I've got a lot of, you know, security controls around that. Specifically, I'm using hardware security modules and other things that don't make it difficult to put it into a platform as a service environment. That's a great place to run it on my own private cloud and keep it there. Analytics was another place, though, where there was already things like Stream Insight and other tools that are delivered through Azure and other platforms where I could say, now I've already got that. I can buy it off the shelf. There's really nothing, you know, differentiating about it. I just want to have somebody that can do this really high-volume analysis of the data that I'm getting in. So let's use what Azure can already do there. And then finally, for ad insertion, I've already got a solution on that. It already runs really well. It runs in my own on-premises environment, and I've tuned it for that. I'm just going to leave it there. So this is a really good example of saying I took this very complex enterprise revenue generating application and I componentized it out and figured out where the right components are to take that model and truly build a hybrid approach to doing it. This is not about SaaS or PaaS or who runs and what data center. This is about leveraging all the best capabilities for each individual circumstance that are there. And this is a great idea, a great model of what hybrid cloud is really all about. It's not about, you know, having to do this or that or run it in this place or that place. It's about how do I combine capabilities. So in summary, if there's only three things that you have to remember, hybrid, again, is not a transitional thing. This is our long-term reality for all of us in this room. This is going to be the reality for all of our careers in the future. Embrace it, love it, hate it, whatever. It is what it is, so we may as well adjust to it. The power of and, it's not about making a choice about do I want to use X or Y or run it in your data center or Microsoft's data center or whatever. It's how do I take all those capabilities and figure out the right way to balance what you have, what I have, what Microsoft delivers, and to put them together in a way that really makes sense. And then finally, to have that commonality of experiences and APIs across those environments. That's how I can scale that out and be able to have that power of and without having to have all the complexity and additional cost of having different tool sets, different user experiences, different admin experiences that are out there. So with that, we're done. We've got some related content here that's on the subsequent slides, some additional resources there. I'd be remiss here if I didn't also point you to the training stuff, and then finally to shamelessly beg you for a survey. If you have time and you want to give us feedback, we always listen to that. I definitely enjoy reading it and using it to improve. So if you have feedback, particularly if you have very good feedback, go ahead and put it into the tool, and we'd appreciate hearing it. And with that, I'll leave it. You guys enjoy the rest of the time in my beautiful state, and don't get in any trouble down in the French Quarter, and have a great day.